Whether it's estimating how much salt we need to keep our roads safe during winter, or if water restrictions are required during a dry spell, the ability to predict future trends in our weather can be very important.
Long-range forecasting, it's a key tool in identifying weather patterns that can influence pretty much everything from economic activity to energy consumption.
A recent icy spell in Ireland and Europe may have been caused by a sudden stratospheric warming. We explore what that is and how it forms.
Hello, and welcome to the Met Aaron podcast. I'm Liz Walsh.
I'm Noel Fitzpatrick, and we're delighted to be back with a new episode and a new season. So we have a whole great lineup of topics and guests coming up over the next few months, and we look forward to having you along with us.
We've actually updated how we publish the podcast this season, so a few changes. We're excited to be teaming up with RTE. So whether you're a new or an existing listener, be sure to subscribe again to the series wherever you get your podcasts. Later on in the podcast, we're going to take a look back at how our climate behaved last year, and keeping on brand for 2020, it wasn't great.
First, though, we're focused on looking into the future, specifically the science of long-range forecasting. Met Aaron has recently launched a monthly forecast, and to help us understand this and long-range forecasts in general, we're joined from Spain by meteorologist and researcher Dr. Laura Zubiate. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Laura, we're familiar with weather forecasts on the radio that maybe give us 2 to 3 days, or on television or on websites, which might be up to a week or a bit longer. When we talk about long-range forecasting, what kind of time ranges are we talking about?
So we can subdivide that into sub-seasonal time ranges, which is from a couple of weeks, like, yeah, after the extended weather forecast, so up to, from 10 days up to 2 months, let's say. And then after that, there's the seasonal forecast that goes from a season, so from 3 months all the way up to maybe 2 years. Those are the time scales. Yes.
And that's obviously quite long time ranges. So obviously the kind of information or the level of detail you can provide in those must be quite different to the information we'd be used to getting from, say, a short range forecast.
Yes, it's very different. The way a sub-seasonal or a seasonal forecast is presented is very different to the typical weather forecast that we see. It's not about maximum or minimum temperatures for a day, or whether it's going to rain or not on a particular day, but it's more about average or trends. The reason this is possible is because there are slowly varying elements in the Earth system, such as the oceans and the cryosphere or the ice, as you know. And those retain more information than the atmosphere. The atmosphere is more chaotic, and in 10 to 15 days, the signal is lost, but these elements retain information from the initial conditions further. So that is why it is possible to forecast not exactly what kind of weather there's going to be in 45 days from now, but next month, is it going to be colder or warmer than average? That's the kind of information that is given.
Okay, and I guess that you mentioned the oceans. I suppose those features are more persistent or long lasting in the oceans, because I mean, we all know water takes a lot of energy to heat up. You know, that's why our kettle uses so much energy, because you need a lot of input into it in order to get your kettle to boil. So it's similar in the ocean, I guess, just on a big scale. If you want to change the temperature of the ocean, it takes a long time.
Yes, that's it. The ocean warms up much slower than the atmosphere, and also cools down much slower than the atmosphere. So there, those are the elements that carry more information into the future.
And in higher latitudes, in places where, in the colder parts of the Earth, where our ocean surfaces can freeze, we have to consider the role of sea ice on our weather as well, right? And on long-term forecasts.
Yes, that's it. That's why that is one of the key elements of the Earth system model that predicts that is used for seasonal forecast, and it's because the frozen surface of the sea creates like a barrier, so the interaction between the ocean and the atmosphere does no longer happen because there's a layer of ice, so that acts as a buffer or as a compartment.
So it's almost acting like a land surface, is that right?
Yes, exactly. It acts more like land than as water, for sure. Yes.
Looking forward, we had dramatically low amounts of sea ice in the Arctic this year, and that was due to climate change. And that's going to have an impact not only on our climate, but on our weather patterns on a relatively short term.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. And if sea ice or the extent of sea ice changes forever, then we cannot even tell what kind of impacts are going to go further down the line.
So long-range forecasts are giving us the general picture, the general trends of whether it'll be warmer or colder, wetter or drier, and I guess how it's differing from the normal or for the usual conditions for that time of year.
Mm-hmm. Why then should we be interested in long-range forecasting? Like, you know, why are people wanting to know these things?
Well, it has applications for energy and farming, but for example, on a subseasonal scale, the kind of things you would be predicting are cold spells, for example, or heat waves. Whereas at the seasonal forecast timescale, maybe you'll be predicting a dry summer or a warm summer. So it's slightly different things that you'll be predicting. But the interest, the applications, of course, of this are farming, whether you're going to have a longer growing season or earlier crops or later crops, droughts, and all the water management bodies may be interested in products like this, knowing what kind of summer you're going to have, especially, or for flood forecasting, if it's going to be very wet, if there's any risk of flooding. But especially, and I want to emphasize this, it's important for energy. Energy is a sector that is interested in what kind of weather there's going to be. For two reasons. One is the what kind of electricity demand there's going to be. If it's a very cold winter, the heating may go up. And if it's a very hot summer, maybe not in Ireland, but in Spain, the air conditionings will be on a lot too. And that's on the demand side. But importantly, now with renewables, also the source, like the production of energy, depends on the weather. Solar panels and wind farms, they depend on whether it's going to be sunny, whether it's going to be windy. So they are interested in the longer range forecast for this reason as well.
So it's kind of like almost like an economic interest. Like, you know, it mm-hmm. kind of the weather is influencing like the economy in a way. And it's not just like, of course, I think like everybody wants to know whether we're going to get a hot summer or it's going to be a really snowy winter. But it is kind of really interesting. That I think there's a lot of research going into it, and we are getting a little bit better at it. So hopefully in the course of this podcast, you might come out and figure out how that research is going, because it's always ongoing, just like the weather is always changing.
Mm-hmm. I believe even some of the big retail outlets use seasonal forecasting for things like, as Laura was saying, if you get hot spell that's forecast coming up, you know, warmer than expected, they'll put in more barbecue supplies mm-hmm. and more sunscreen and things like that. So it's in use in very practical ways, I think, even already.
Yes, yeah, since the weather affects so much of the economic activities and the activities of society.
In the last, I suppose, over the last 20 years, we've seen major improvements in weather forecasting models. Like, you know, you can't deny that, you know, the weather forecast has got better, even though some people would say it hasn't, but like, believe me, it has. We have the graphs to show it. But we've seen an explosion of like computer power. And it's also related to recent advancements in knowledge and understanding of how the climate and the whole Earth system works. Can you tell me a little bit more about how the modeling side of things works in long range forecasting?
Yes, so for a long range or seasonal forecast, you need a model that depicts the whole Earth system. So not only an atmospheric model that resolves the equations of the atmosphere, but you also need an oceanic model that resolves the equations of the ocean. And those two have to be linked. So that is a coupled model. And it would also include the ice that we were talking about and the land surface. So all these elements that change on different timescales would have to be present in the model, in the system, and coupled to each other so that they exchange information.
What you're saying with the chaos and the equations of the atmosphere, the main problem, I think, with any weather forecast really is the exponential growth, like the massive growth of errors with time, because the atmosphere, like you said, is a chaotic system. So we basically get You know, that idea, Loren's idea of the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil could cause like a tornado in Texas, something like that. Okay, so it's a small, tiny differences make a huge difference in the grand scale of things. And that's how like chaos works. So one way to get over that, that big problem, I guess, that we have with the maths of weather forecasting, is to use an ensemble prediction system. So so can you just explain to me a little about what ensemble is and how we use that in long range forecasting?
Yes, so an ensemble prediction is a set of prediction. They don't just make one, they don't produce one forecast, but they produce a set of forecasts. And these are initialized with slightly different initial conditions. That's one way of doing it. In long range forecast, I don't think it's done in normal weather forecast, but in long range forecast, you can also create your ensemble by time lagging. You can initiate your forecast in slightly different times. Instead of changing initial conditions, you change the time. And at the end, you have the same set, because it doesn't really matter if it starts 12 hours before or 12 hours later. You're not looking at that. That time scale is not of your interest. The interest is the average over 3 months. So that is another way of constructing a building an ensemble in long range forecast.
So that's really interesting, because I, you know, when we're doing just like day-to-day forecasting, we're really concentrated on the actual minute that the forecast like time starts. But with long range forecasting, you don't have to be that precise, I guess. You can vary it from day to day, or 12 hours late and 12 hours early. And because you're not actually looking at the exact detail, you're looking for the trend.
As you said, Laura, we change our initial conditions, we vary them slightly, or we time lag it, is because we have this uncertainty with these errors, we put in a range of different values to start with so that we can see what the likely spread of those errors will be over time. And that will give us a range to work with, right? So that's why we make those changes to the initial conditions at the start. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And at the end, you'll have as many forecasts as you initialized, and you can calculate statistics of those forecasts. And that is another way that you'll always see seasonal forecast in probability terms and in statistical terms, never as deterministic. So there's a way it is presented usually is there is 50% probability of it being a warmer than average summer and 30% of it being colder than average. That kind of information is given because you have so many forecasts.
So we have an ensemble model, as you say, so a model with lots of different elements to it with slightly different starting conditions. And for seasonal forecasting, as you said, or long-range forecasting, we use a coupled model. So it's not just the atmosphere, it's also the ocean, it's the land surface, it's the sea ice. So lots to consider there. Also, when we're looking at long time ranges, we need to start thinking about what's happening in other parts of the globe that might eventually affect our weather. And we come to this term called teleconnections. Can you tell us what a teleconnection is?
Teleconnection is pattern of weather, maybe pressure or sea surface temperatures, that occurs in one part of the world that has influence in a different part of the world.
So if we think about one of the really large scale teleconnections, and many people will have heard of El Nino, for example, but that's sort of one part of a two-part system, right? This El Nino Southern Oscillation. So we'll just call it ENSO for this, to keep it nice and short. But you have El Nino and its sister, I guess, La Nina. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Yes. So ENSO, I think it's the biggest source of interannual variability in climate in the world. And it has been known for many years. First of all, it was known by fishermen, because what they observed, the fishermen in the western coast of America, of South America, was that some years the anchovies wouldn't show up. They weren't there, basically. And this is because there's warm waters on the surface along the equator and off the coast of Peru, let's say, for example. And in those latitudes, the prevailing winds are easterlies. So these easterly winds would push those warm waters further west into the Pacific, and that would allow for cold waters rich in nutrients to upwell from deeper. And that's good for fisheries. Then all these nutrients would bring primary production and then fish. When the easterlies are not there, the warm water stay on the surface. And that's not good because then you don't have the rich nutrient-rich cold waters upwelling from the bottom and you have warm waters and there's no fish. So that's how it was first observed, that phenomenon. And La Niña is when you have stronger than usual easterly winds. So then all the warm water gets pushed even further west and there's colder waters in the Pacific, in the west, eastern Pacific.
Okay, so you get this change in surface temperature patterns and in wind patterns, I guess, in as you say, in the central equatorial Pacific. How does that affect the weather globally then?
Well, of course, the warm waters on the surface are the ones that trigger then convection, and that has the influence on the circulation. So the effects of El Niño are far-reaching, and they create a set of correlations with cold and dry or warm and wet conditions, in at least in North America, South America, all of Asia, Australia, and even in Africa.
And that's, so as you say, convection, that mm-hmm. rising of air that you get in the tropical regions.
Wow. Yes, it is first the sea surface temperatures that drive the convection, and that drives the rest of the circulation.
How often does it switch between the two phases, between El Niño and La Niña?
There isn't a periodicity. I've been looking at the time series, and in every decade there will be maybe a strong El Niño event, but it doesn't have, you can't say that it has a periodicity of 10 years because it doesn't. Mm. So I think the onset is around May and it peaks in October. So it is mainly, it influences most noticeable during the late autumn and winter in the world, and then it decays at the end of spring. So it is an annual cycle, but whether you're going to get El Niño or La Niña, or how strong the event is going to be, that's the periodicity that is not well known, or it hasn't been observed.
We talked about El Niño there, and that's an example, I think, of a teleconnection that is kind of a seasonal teleconnection. So you talked about it's over the boreal winter, or like autumn mm-hmm. into winter and early spring. So there are other teleconnections that are shorter kind of duration, mm-hmm. if you like. They're kind of, and they're more of the sub-seasonal time scale. And so one of those that we know about is the MJO, or the Madden-Julian Oscillation, is this cluster of thunderstorms that kind of behave like a wave, and they move around the tropics in a wave-like manner. They originate over the Indian Ocean and then move eastwards into kind of towards out to the Pacific, really. And it's a process that takes anywhere between 30 and 60 days. And that can have a strong effect on the weather in Europe too, can't it?
Yeah, so the effect, because the MJO is a sub-seasonal phenomena, it lasts between 30 and 60 days, as you said, the effects are seen also more immediately. So after a certain phase of the MJO, you may see particular weather pattern or a particular position of the jet stream in Europe, and the opposite on another phase of the MJO, 10 to 15 days later, the effect is seen already in Northern Europe or in Europe.
Okay. So what you're beginning to talk about there, from what I understand, like you're talking about the shifting of the jet stream, and that's another teleconnection. So it's just like, I'm just going to blow everybody's mind. We've got the El Niño Southern Oscillation, we've had the Madden-Julian Oscillation, but now we've got the one that I think you might actually hear about in the press here sometimes. I mean, it's a North Atlantic Oscillation.
That's the big one in Europe, and it is what determines the kind of weather that we get in Europe, or yeah, Western Europe at least, and also North America. But yeah, it is the way it is defined is, let's say you have the Icelandic low pressure and the Azores high, which are usually there, but depending on how strong the gradient between them is, you get an NAO positive or an NAO negative. If you have a well-defined Azores high and a well-defined Icelandic low, it means there's a great big pressure difference between the two of them. And that is, if it's stronger than average, that's called an NAO positive. And what that brings is a very zonal jet stream and a very zonal flow in general. So you get warmer, wetter than average and windier than average winters in Ireland, for sure, and in Western Europe in general. Whereas if you don't have those very well-defined Icelandic low and Azores high, the pressure gradient is weaker and the jet stream, the flow gets a little bit diverted to the south, and you may have cold weather or high pressures moving in from the east. So that is an NAO negative situation. A famous one is the winter of 2010 in Ireland, which was very, very cold. And that was a typical NAO
negative
and strong NAO negative winter. Yes.
What one way, when I think of the NAO and I'm sort of visualizing it, I often picture the low pressure over Iceland, you know, it's spinning counterclockwise, and the high pressure over the Azores spinning mm-hmm. clockwise. And they're like two wheels or two gears in a machine that are sort of pulling the weather in between them across Europe. And if their position changes or if the strength of their rotation changes, then that changes the track of that weather or so across Europe. Mm-hmm. You mentioned zonal flow. Can you just explain to us what you meant by that?
Yeah, zonal flow, as opposed to meridional flow, is the one that goes from west to east or from east to west, but parallel to the equator, whereas meridional is perpendicular to the equator, north to south or south to north.
Sometimes during the winter here in Ireland, we have we hear about the stratospheric polar vortex, which sounds very dramatic, and mm-hmm. it gets a lot of attention here because something related to that sudden stratospheric warming can sometimes be associated with icy cold weather, and it gets picked up in the newspapers. But what is the stratospheric polar vortex?
So the same as there's a polar vortex in the troposphere, which is the part of the atmosphere where we are, the same happens. There's a similar thing above in the layer of the atmosphere above, and the stratospheric polar vortex spins. It has mainly westerly flow. So yes, when the stratospheric polar vortex is spinning from the west, the same as the tropospheric one, that is the normal situation. But sometimes this flow gets reversed. So you start getting, it starts slowing down first, and then it may even reverse, and you may have easterly flow in the stratospheric polar vortex that creates a sudden stratospheric warming.
And as you say, that's it's a change in the normal circulation, and then that filters down and can lead to a change in the usual flow and the usual direction that we get on our weather on the ground. Is that right?
Yeah, so what happens in the stratosphere, not always, but it does have a downward effect. What exactly the effect is going to be is not so easy to predict, but there is an influence. Yeah, more or less 2/3 of those southern stratospheric warming events that we see will result in an NAO negative situation, in a persistent NAO negative situation, which is the cold weather and the easterlies and the blocking situations that we were talking about before. And there was a big event 2 years ago, and it resulted in that, in the beast from the east coming, and yeah, the storm Emma. So now we think that it's always going to happen, but it doesn't necessarily,
yeah, because it happened last year as well, mm-hmm. didn't it? And yes. Nothing happened.
No, nothing happened. I think there was some cold in North America, but nothing happened in Europe. So, yeah. So yes.
So it does vary. It doesn't automatically mean that we'll get cold weather in Europe.
No.
But it can improve the chances of it happening, though.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
So recently we had a bit of an icy patch here in Ireland and in Europe as well. And we knew that there was a sudden stratospheric warming event taking place. We knew that for the last few weeks. But the local effects of that, we wouldn't have known until our short range forecasts were ready and out. But having had that little bit of advance warning time that those models had given us, it allowed us to get prepared should there be a major event, and to do other things like notify local and government authorities so they can get prepared and bring in the necessary plans. It was then from the short range forecast that we could see that it was probably going to be a relatively minor event. But at that stage, everything was in place should something more serious have developed with that.
So we've touched on some of the processes, including various teleconnections and sea ice and the stratospheric polar vortex that can influence our weather here in Europe on a seasonal and subseasonal basis. Laura, how do all these sometimes competing signals affect the accuracy or the skill of the long-term forecast?
The skill of the seasonal forecast where we are in Europe is very, very low. Okay. So everywhere else in the world, if you have a strong El Niño, you know more or less what's going to happen. And even though if you don't have a strong El Niño, it may be more uncertain, but at least if you have a strong signal from one side in the tropics, you know what's going to happen. Whereas in Europe, the skill is very low. And the reasons for that are probably all the ones that we've mentioned so far. And it is that there are so many pathways leading to Europe. So there are so many factors affecting our weather in Europe that is why I think the skill of the seasonal prediction is very, very low.
That's a nice way to put it. All right. So there are so many, as you say, so many pathways, all these different features affecting the weather in Europe, and no pathway has a strong enough footprint to let us know which direction it's going to go. Whereas in other parts of the world, there might be one feature that has, you know, has the strongest footprint, so to speak, and we know it's going to follow that direction, and our skill then for our forecast is stronger.
Yes.
So the Madrid snow, that epic snowfall that we saw in Madrid, was down to an NAO negative situation, a North Atlantic oscillation that was negative, blocking situation. And for that reason, the storm track had been shifted to the south. So they had a great situation where they had low pressure, a bit like Emma and Beast for the East for us. But Storm Emma, they had Storm Philomena, which interacted with really cold air and caused that epic snowfall. And of course, I was there going, Madrid, it's so far south. And then I had to look and I realized it's one of the highest capital cities in Europe. So, you know, altitude counts, you know, when you're talking about snow, you need a bit of altitude sometimes. But yeah, I think that was a pretty well forecasted event, Laura, wasn't it?
Yes, I think they do get a little bit of snow every year in Madrid, but something like that was like a 30-year snowstorm, and they're not used to that, obviously, nobody is. But yeah, that was forecast, I think, 8 days in advance. I think the 30th of December, AMED already published an advisory. And then as it progressed, they released the warnings, and it went from yellow, from orange warning, and the night before it was a red warning. So they were predicting already anywhere between 20 and 50 centimeters of snow accumulation, which is massive. But I think their forecast was good, and they saw it well in advance.
So there was skill in the long range forecast from that perspective there, definitely within the 2 week time range. Which is normally kind of not, like sometimes you'd say, oh, it's not really reliable. That actually turned out to be a really reliable one.
So Met Aaron have launched a monthly forecast. It's published on the Met Aaron website underneath the forecast tab. And it's updated twice a week. So it's on Tuesday and Friday afternoons. So I'm sure you've had a look at this yourself, Liz. It's a 4 week forecast. Broken down into the main conditions and trends for each week. So it's as we've mentioned, it's not going to be giving you the detail of what the rain is going to be doing on any given day, but it's going to tell you, you know, if it's going to be wetter or drier than normal, or warmer or colder than it normally would be for this time of year, things like that.
Yeah, and it would also tell you about the reliability of it, really, because as we've discussed, sometimes these forecasts can be more reliable at times than at others. So, you know, if we're kind of more confident in the forecast, it will say that in the forecast, whereas if there's low confidence, it's also going to say that too.
So it's a useful planning tool. And then, but what you're saying is continue to use the short-term forecast then for when you're zoning in on whatever day it is that you're
exactly
interested in.
Laura, it was great to have you on with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much to you both. It was great. It was a pleasure. And I hope I explained things well.
It was great. Thanks, Laura. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
So every month on the podcast, we'll be bringing you climate change updates and any current developments in the science. So we've just been talking about long-range forecasting, but the background state or background conditions to any of these forecasts is our climate. And as we know, in the last few years, or recent years, our climate has been changing and changing quite significantly. So 2020, the year just passed, was tied with 2016 as the warmest year on record. So this is coming from Copernicus, which is the European Union's Earth Observation Program. And this means that we have this incredible situation where the last 6 years have been the six warmest years on record. So Europe had its warmest year on record, and regions like the Arctic and Siberia had temperatures, annual temperatures, more than 6 degrees above average, which is an incredible statistic. We had major heat waves in those regions in 2020 and ones that persisted for several weeks, which led to those high averages. And to keep in mind with that as well is we had a La Nina conditions developing during 2020, and they're generally associated with slightly cooler global temperatures. So to still have a record-breaking warm year in 2020 with La Nina present as well is a worrying statistic. Another thing that we associate obviously with climate change is that there's an increased likelihood of extreme weather events and extreme sort of weather-related events in general. We had no shortage of those in 2020, did we, Liz?
No, we didn't. Definitely climate change manifests through like the changing likelihoods and intensities of these extreme weather events. And we definitely saw our fair share of those. It started out with the Australian bushfires. You may remember like when the sun was basically obscured by the smoke from the Australian bushfires. And they say now that those Australian bushfires were at least 30% more likely due to the climate change warming that has occurred already. And what's interesting as well is that, you know, the climate forecast models, they don't simulate actually extreme temperatures so well. And in fact, they're often too low or too cold with those extreme temperatures.
So those conservative models are saying 30%, whereas that percentage could in fact be higher.
It could in fact be higher. So it started out though with the Australian bushfires, and there were bushfires actually all over the world. I mean, the world was on fire in 2020, South America, and of course, California, where you saw greater than 4 million acres. And also the same thing where the sun obscured by the smoke in the sky. And that 4 million acres went up in flames, and that was like double the previous wildfire record there, which is just like it's crazy to think about. Now you have to say that like forest management played an important role in the situation in California. I think as you've seen reported in the press and stuff like that, but those fires were definitely more likely because of climate change. Whether that's through forest management or whatever, we do need to learn how to deal with them in the future.
And it was a very active hurricane season as well in 2020.
Yep, the hurricane season was one of the most active that they've seen. There was a record number, for the season at the start, it actually kicked off before the season started. So the North Atlantic hurricane season, that is. So this is another thing, actually interesting. La Nina causes a more active North Atlantic hurricane season and a kind of a more inactive Pacific hurricane season. So just another thing, those teleconnections creeping in there again. But anyway, with the hurricane season, it was extremely active. In 2005 was an extreme year. That was the year of Hurricane Katrina. Yeah. But they had a load of storms. And this year actually surpassed the number of storms that happened in 2005. Now, while 2020 didn't have the same strength, I guess, of storms, there were a lot of Category 5s in 2005. But just for the sheer number of storms that occurred during the hurricane season, this was a record-breaking year, 2020 was. And there were two Category 4 hurricanes, in fact, almost near the end of the season, which hit, which is kind of October, November, so really quite late. They hit the same area in Nicaragua within less than 2 weeks. So imagine having a Category 4 hurricane, like not just one, but going through two. Nicaragua, that area in Nicaragua, Central America, was completely devastated. Yeah. By that. So yeah, it's definitely quite worrying. seeing these extremes of weather events.
Absolutely. As you say, there's more energy. Our oceans are warmer, which fuels the energy for hurricanes, and we're increasing the odds and increases the chances of stormier seasons and of the impacts that we saw in places like Nicaragua, where we have, if you have more hurricanes occurring, there's more chances of them making landfall and to have events like that.
And the hurricane season is an example of a successful seasonal forecast that was made by the National Hurricane Center. At the start of the season, they were forecasting a more active season than normal, from April onwards. And they were attributing that to the La Nina, the development of the La Nina, which is a known precursor to a more active North Atlantic hurricane season. And as the season went along, they fine-tuned that seasonal forecast, and it did actually eventually become one of the most, if not the most active hurricane season that we've seen.
Yeah, as you say, they had quite a lot of confidence as well in that forecast, and I guess that was down to the strength of the La Nina conditions that were developing. And they obviously each year would go back and look at their forecasts and see what the strength of it was, and to try and verify their methods and to verify their approach. And that's something that happens not only for long-term forecasting, but short-range forecasting as well. We will look back on previous forecasts, see how well they performed, and look at what we could learn from it and what we improved. So there were some positive signals also in terms of climate change. We saw a reduction in CO2 emissions in 2020. So this was due to the economic slowdown and the travel restrictions associated with COVID-19. So in Ireland, this amounted to about a 6% reduction in emissions. So it will be interesting to see if we can maintain those reductions when the restrictions are lifted. We've also recently seen the United States rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, and that's a very positive development also.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Our thanks again to Laura for joining us this month and helping us to understand a little bit more about long-range forecasting. If you want to take a deeper dive into the science behind it all, you can find all manner of graphs and graphics at met.ie/forecast/monthly forecast.
Thanks for tuning in. Next month, we'll be exploring the many effects of weather and climate on our physical and mental well-being, as well as on global health. We'd love to have you on board for that and for the season as a whole. So be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Feel free to get in touch about this episode or any weather and climate related comments or pictures you have on the Met Éireann or RTE Weather social channels, or you could email us at podcast@met.ie or weather@rte.ie.
We'll be releasing new episodes on the last Thursday of every month. So until next time, thanks for listening and take care.
The Met Éireann podcast was researched and presented by Dr. Noel Fitzpatrick and Liz Walsh. Production and editing is by Jandy Langone.